Welcome to today's episode. My name is Wyatt Hammond, and I am the host of the Taming Tribulation podcast.
And my name is Jeremy Crossley, your co-host for the podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's episode.
This episode contains descriptions of violence. Please use discretion. Welcome to another episode of Taming Tribulation. This is a special one because it's just Jeremy and I talking about Jeremy's military experience. So we don't have a guest on the show today where it's just going to be him and I. So first of all, let's jump into it with me just asking you the question to start us off, Jeremy. How did you end up joining the military in the first place?
So I joined the military when I was 17 years old is when I signed the dotted line. And obviously you needed parental consent in order to join the military. And I grew up in a very toxic city my whole life, and I didn't really have much of a life, a disciplined lifestyle, I guess.
What city was it?
I was in Fall River, Massachusetts.
Okay.
So it was it was full of a lot of crime.
So you joined when you were 18.
Yeah. Technically, I was 17. I did what they call a delayed entry program, and then
you were desperate to get in.
Yeah, I was for it. You know, I was full sending it.
Yeah.
And I left about a month after I turned 18. Graduated high school, and I made the nice the honor roll with a bunch of D's and two A's. So pushed on through, and then the month after my 18th birthday, I was on a way to Fort Benning, Georgia, to basic.
Very cool. So what was the desire at 17 to join the military, and what made you want to do that?
So I just, like I said, my whole life has been full of complications, and I've seen people join the military and what they've become. I've seen people come back. I've seen the amount of discipline they've had, and I never had any of that. You know, when I went to high school, I was in this program called the JROTC, and it was kind of like a paramilitary class in which we were, structured to be like a little disciplined class about military, and it was like a Navy JROTC. So we were in like uniforms every Wednesday, and we had like certain things we had to do in order to get promoted. And anyone who knows anything about it, they're going to be like, yeah, that was kind of whack. But it gave me a little bit of like an insight of like, all right, so yeah, I got to cut my hair, I got to shave my beard, I got to wear a uniform, look presentable, stuff like that. And I kind of like that. I like that that discipline, and that call for something more. So I was just like, let's do it. Let's see what the Army is like. And I chose the Army specifically because I could choose my job, the job that I wanted. And I didn't like the having to go into the military and them being like, well, you're going to be a cook for 4 years, you know. A lot of the other branches, you can't really pick your job. They kind of like put you where they want you. And because of my intellect, I probably would have been a grunt anyways if I joined the Marine Corps. Joined the Army.
That. Nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I joined the Army, and I decided to join the paratroopers. And I was scared to death about jumping out of an airplane, but I did it anyways because they were like, yeah, you got extra money. I was like, cool. Sounds good. So yeah. And I joined the Army at 17, and that was it. Joined the Infantry Airborne.
So you were looking for structure and someone to lead you to something. You didn't have much discipline in your life. And so you thought, hey, I've seen other people become successful and out of the military. So if I want to have that kind of success, I'll do the same thing. That was the thought process.
Exactly. And I didn't really want to stay at home either because there was nothing here for me.
Cool. Next question was how long were you in the military for?
So I was in the Army active duty for 4 years. And then I did the National Guard for another 4 years, so a total of 8 years.
So from yeah. like 18 to 26.
Yeah.
Yeah. And where did you go?
I was in Fort Benning, Georgia for basic. I went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina for my first duty station. And then I went to Afghanistan in 2012. And I came back to Fort Bragg, got out, went back up to Boston, and was in two infantry units up in Boston.
And so how long were you in Afghanistan for?
About 10 months. I did like a little 10-month tour.
What are those memories like?
So it was my first deployment, and I was 19 years old, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into. We knew the mission statement when going into Afghanistan, but we didn't actually know the mission statement, if that makes sense. They were like, well, these are our plans, and this is the intel we have, and you're going to have to go and occupy some land, some villages. And, you know, obviously as a first time deployer, I don't know what the heck any of that means other than I better get used to it and see how it goes. In the back of my head, I was like, this is going to be awesome, right? This ain't going to be too bad. And, obviously like leaving my family and stuff was tough, but, yeah, so we did another full send into Afghanistan in the beginning of the year 2012, and we didn't really know what the heck we were getting ourselves into, and we flew right into Kandahar. We flew from North Carolina to Germany to Kyrgyzstan to Kandahar. So yeah, and we were in it since day one. So
and so for those
it
for
was
those,
an experience
those 10 months how much action did you see?
Every day we saw something. So we were originally at a patrol base that was about a company sized patrol base. It was called AJK. It was in RC south of Afghanistan, about 70 miles southwest of Kandahar. We had to fly a Chinook into the patrol base, which shows you it had a pretty large airfield, which was nice. The unit that was there before us was the 10th Mountain Artillery Unit, and they did a great job fortifying it, that's for sure. They turned the entire place into kind of like a little luxury company size base, which it's nothing like Kandahar, nothing like any battalion FOB. It was big enough to where you could fit a company size, about 150 people, maybe a little bit more. In this area. So we were there for about 3 months until the first day we landed in the Chinook and we took contact, meaning like we were shot at by the Taliban. And every day we went out, we did a patrol, sometimes two patrols, and then did guard duty. And every day we went out, I remember day one, we went to a little patrol base that was offset from the larger company size patrol base where a platoon would go out and like do operations out of there. And we went down there with EOD, and day one, the EOD we had with us got shot, and one guy got shot in the butt. And then the other guy got shot in the plate carrier, hit his ribs, and it shot out of his back. He was okay in the context of like, it didn't hit him at major organs or anything like that. But yeah, both of them got shot day one, and we were all like, oh, this is gonna be fun. But it, you know, that was a day one. And I think we got shot at every single day that we were there up until, until we left. So we left for a different area. So our goal there, our goal there was to essentially push the Taliban further south, get them away, because we were at like the southernmost part where Taliban was actually originally established. So we were pushing them out of their home turf, bringing them down south, just away from any of the big patrol bases. So we were very successful. We ended up, we were first platoon of the first of the 508th Paratroop Infantry Regiment. And we kicked butt every single day. We did two, three patrols. We were shot at all the time in our little patrol base that we had, that was south of the company size. And we put in work. We did a lot of IEDs. We found a whole bunch of IEDs. We would walk in like little ducks in a row anywhere we went. So we would have this thing called a mine hound, which was essentially a metal detector. And we would walk like little duckies in a row, making sure we wouldn't step on any of the IEDs. Because what mainly messed us up were the IEDs. If we missed one, if we missed the indicator of one or anything like that. So we had to walk like that for hours. And as you can imagine, just to go a mile, very slow pace, swinging around a metal detector, making sure you're not pinging anything, it would take a while. So yeah, it would be a great opportunity for like Taliban to try to ambush us. Which they did a lot. They did do a lot. Our platoon was known for the platoon that if we took pop shots, what we call it, we would just lay down lead down. We would lay the lead down range, meaning they would shoot 25 bullets at us. We'd shoot 2,500 at them, which some people were like, why do you got to shoot? It's like, it's just the purpose of, you know, what we call suppressive fire. Yeah. And just to show them, like, we're not being messed with, we'll lay hate on you no matter what. So, yeah.
Everyone knows the Americans certainly weren't there just to joke around, right? That was that was a long and vicious war. And for how many times you shot it at someone else, obviously that was my next question, which is, if you were shot at every day, then you shot at someone else every day pretty much, right?
Yeah. Hundreds and hundreds of times.
And you know, so is there a kill count?
No. I do remember the first time I got the enemy, my first confirmed kill. It's not something we really brag about.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I was 19 years old and I was set to do something for the country. And, so I remember the first time I had what we call a 320 or a 203 grenade launcher. And I used to, my job was to shoot grenades and smokes and all like HE rounds, high explosive rounds at enemy, and like, you know, shoot them with the M4. I remember we were getting shot at returning from a mission, and at this burnt out bus that was just in the middle of the land. And I remember, it's cool. If you know the battle drills of an infantryman, there's something that's called break contact. It's one of the battle drills that we have. And when we break contact, we try to like break contact away. So what I did was, they call it an Aussie peel. So we Aussie peel around the 240 Bravo gun team to then shoot, you know, so because they were the limit, so, you know, because they have a more limitation as far as their gunfire. But I lobbed, and we had this camera in the sky that videoed all of this. So I lobbed a 203 grenade launcher, a grenade, essentially shot it at the burnt out bus, and I guess it like blew up one of the dudes. And I remember, like, I didn't even notice, you know what I mean, because it was kind of far away, a couple hundred meters away, and he got blown to smithereens. And I remember going back to the patrol base after the firefight, and the first son, like, looking at me, he's like, we got you on camera. We saw you lob that 203 at that guy, and he's done. He's like, you effing messed him up. And I was like, yeah, you know,
camera.
Because, you know,
how many
trained,
kills are put on camera?
Huh?
How many kills are put on camera? Like, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I don't know. It was a lot. But it's a good feeling that, you know, at the time, obviously, it was a good feeling that
you were doing your job.
You train for months and months and months to do something, and when you finally, you know, you get it, they're all like, "Yeah." So,
well, and it's also they were trying to kill you too, right? Like, you're not, you know, so you're,
yeah,
not murdering.
Stop the threat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And so that was your first one, and it was memorable because it was on camera. That's pretty neat.
Yeah. And it was just 19-year-old me jumping for joy. Like, I don't know how to describe it. I was just like, yeah, like doing, like, so happy. It was, the hype was real that day. That's for sure.
Yeah. So was there any moments during your deployment where you thought, this is it, I'm done, they got me? Were there any of those moments?
Not necessarily like they got me, because I never gave up. As far as, like, you know, I did have a lot of moments of, you know, today's probably going to be the last day I live. There was a lot of firefights where we were pinned down. There was a lot of IED situations in which we easily could have been ambushed.
Right.
So, you know, when you're moving at night too, I think it's probably one of the scariest things to do, is moving at night in a minefield. I think that was probably the scariest things, because Taliban didn't know when we were leaving. They didn't know. It's weird. It's like they had a bird watching us the entire time whenever we would leave, because we would always change up our patterns, but they always knew when we were leaving. So, I had a lot of, is today going to be the last day, thoughts in my head, especially at that age. So
were you prepared for that reality, or was that a scary thought to you? Did you think, hey, I'm a soldier, that's why I'm here, if I go, I go? Or was that, were you desperate to get home, and was that a scary thought?
A bit of both. I think there was a, you know, this is what I'm here to do, and if I die here, this is how I'm going out. But there was a part of me that was like, yeah, no, like, I'm going out, but, you know, I do want to go back home. Because you get desensitized to it, right? You get desensitized to getting shot at. You kind of, like, there are moments where I didn't even, like, they tell you to shoot back and take a knee. There were moments where I didn't take a knee. There was moments where I was hoping I'd get shot, but it wouldn't be lethal. There were moments where, I wanted to go home, because it kind of gets annoying at times too. You get to a level where you're just tired of getting shot at. You want them to just stop shooting at you, because it gets annoying. So, but yeah, there were both. They were both moments.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, I'd imagine that's how a lot of people feel when they're in that position, right? That they know that they're there for that job, but still they're like, I still want to live the rest of my life, right? Just because you're a soldier doesn't mean you're just giving up on you know, all the hopes and dreams you had before. So I want to move on to the lessons that you learned from war. The title of this one is going to be five lessons learned from war from a young veteran. So what's the first of the five lessons that you took home, whether it be about life or about war or about yourself? Or,
well, I think the first one of the first lessons I think I've ever learned was to have, I'm going to say this politely, was to have a kind of like a whatever mentality. Like, if it happens, it happens. I had this squad leader, his name was Christopher Jensen. He is one of my heroes still to this day, who he was a very strict squad leader, to say the least. But I remember clear as day that he always said to me, he said, Jeremy, because I'm not going to lie, I was not the best soldier at 19 years old, as anyone can imagine, 18, 19 years old, you're not the best human, never mind the best soldier. But I remember he pulled me aside one day and he said, and he was like, he said it with such like confidence. It's what I loved about what he said. He is just like, he just goes up to me, he goes, Crossley, he's like, F it. And I was like, what do you mean, Saj? He's like, F it. No matter what, just say that in your head over and over again, and things will get a lot better for you. And I always took that to heart. So I think having the first lesson I always thought would be, I always had, was to just say, if it happens, it happens. You can't change it. You can just adapt to it. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's with anything in life. I think if you can try to change it to make it better, then try to change it to make it better. Not easier, because easier is not always better, but just have the mentality of like, this is what I was given and I'm going to run with it the best I can. Right. So that's what I always had from my first lesson. Lesson number two. Yeah. And I still use that today. You know, don't complain when things go wrong, like work through it, push through it.
I would imagine that, you know, when you're in a life and death situation, like you're in war and you're getting shot at every day and shooting every day and stuff like that, you'd come home and the problems here would seem a lot smaller, right? And so the effort here is a lot easier than the effort there, right? Like effort there, you're running into dangerous situation that could be your last moments, right? But here it's like something you're scared of doing, you know, the things that people think are actually scary things, carrying that attitude over to effort, just do it. Like, no point in sitting around waiting for other things to happen. So that's a cool lesson. So move on to number two for us.
Well, I like to talk about that first part too, real quick. Is like it's a great perception to have, but because people don't realize, like, Afghanistan was easy in the sense of what was the mission, what needed to get done, right? Like, that was clear as day to me. But when you're back home, this is why I take my hat off to all law enforcement or first responders or anyone like that who work in the medical field, the police field, any of that, because their job is actually more difficult. Because in war, like, you're away from your family, and that's crappy, right? But the mission was easy. You do a mission and you destroy the enemy, right? Here, it's every little thought is you got to take captive, right? Every little thought you take captive, and you understand, like, there are so many different intricate parts that play here. So it's definitely a different mentality here than it is overseas. When you come back home, you're like, yeah, if I'm getting shot at, that mentality of effort should be, like, I can't change this guy getting shot. All I can do, I can't react with emotions.
Right.
You know, I need to respond with action. And I think that's a call to do something higher. So in that retrospect to that word, I think that's what that always, you know, came to me. But yeah, the lesson number two was, like, be a team player. I think that's something I really, really can't stress enough. And you're in these environments, like, stop. Like, I recommend everybody to stop thinking about just themselves. Mm-hmm. It's not about you in these environments. It's about your brother or your sister to the left or right of you, right? And you can't think you can take it on. You can't take on the hill by yourself. Don't be that guy. You know, people are on the side of, to the left and your right, and you need to encourage them, help them out, be there for them when they're feeling crappy. You know, at the time we would hand out cigarettes when people were stressed. We'd be there for each other, you know? And I think that was something that, like I said, really kept close. Cause if I didn't have people to my left and my right, and I was standing there, I would be a mess, right?
There's no situation in life where you're going to achieve anything meaningful by yourself.
Exactly. Right?
Whether it's in war, accomplishing a mission, or in business, or spirituality, or really anything that you want to accomplish that will actually bring anything good to the world, you need other people to do it, right? You need other skills, and if you think you can do it all on your own, you're gonna fail miserably and fall flat on your face. And the same applies to war, obviously, right? So that's another great one. So number three,
I would say, is, like with anything, have a great support system. I think one of the lessons I learned, I mean, it's from war, the aftermath of it too, was very difficult for me to adapt into society. I know a lot of veterans come back from war and they just don't know where to turn. You know, they give you this, oh, the VA is going to help you out. But a lot of people switch over to drugs and alcohol, and a lot of people are just lost. So having a great support system, I had a support system coming back, but it wasn't the best. You know, I had a family and stuff, but, like, they don't, like, what do they tell you when you come back from war? Like, hey, you know, you have fun over there, you know,
no one can relate. Right. I'm exactly. Sure. I would just imagine you'd come home and it'd seem like what a weird life to leave and then to come back to. Right. And,
yeah,
it would be impossible for people that have just, they just lived, carried on their life for 10 months and you were just in war for 10 months and now you're just trying to come back and relate to each other. It's almost impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a lot of people like who don't know, like, I guess, quote unquote, the life. You know, like a lot of people ask the same questions, like, what did you do over there? Or like, you see these little, you know, rom-com movies or these war movies where like, how did you survive? And they got all these crazy speeches, but it's like, you come back and it's scarier to be back home than it is to be overseas because of everything. And I learned, and I'm talking, I want to say this too specifically. I was talking to someone the other day, you know, going away from your family is one thing, right? But like being away from everything and being a combat veteran is a lot different than being I just deployed. You know, and I say this delicately because there are people that might listen to this that be like, you know, I was in Kuwait or I was in South Korea or I was in Germany, and it's like, no, we're talking about combat deployments. We're not talking
Afghanistan in 2008 is a little different than Germany in 2008.
Yes, a lot different.
Yeah,
and I have empathy for those who feel like that year away from their family and Kuwait or Germany was tough, you know, and I have empathy for those who are in Kandahar airfield their entire deployment and they have 4 square meals a day and the gym and electricity and phone time. But that's different. That's a different level of quote unquote deployment. And people need to understand, like, that's also a big factor in it too, because like, you'll have little Jimmy over here crying because he hasn't seen his family in 6 months. And then you'll have James over here who hasn't cried at all because he needs to stay strong and be alive for his family when he leaves the wire and he gets shot at, right? And blown up and all this stuff. So I think, big difference.
Different levels of commitment. So lesson 4?
It ties into a little bit about what I said about lesson 2. It's about, you know, whenever you get something, don't complain about it, right? Whenever a task is given to you, a mission is given to you, like, it's easy for us to moan and groan and complain. Mm-hmm. Or with anything that happens in life, I think don't be the one that sits there and rolls your eyes and huffs and puffs because everyone else around you is probably thinking the same thing. But you're ruining the morale of people by also complaining, you know what I mean, with them. Like, they all think the same thing. When it's raining out and you guys are out in the rain and they're all soaking wet and you're freezing, don't be the one to complain about it. Laugh with it. Use humor as a way to, like, get through it because everyone else is sitting there saying the same thing on the inside. You're just being the one that looks like the weak one and is going to complain about it. And there's just a... That's a big lesson that I learned even in my today's job about, you know, you get assigned a sector or a shift or whatever. Don't sit there and be like, oh, this is the worst thing ever. Why do I got to be here? Why can't he? Like, that's not going to get you anywhere in life. And nobody likes hearing that.
What I'm hearing in that one is don't be the weak link.
Yeah. Don't be the weak chain. Right. So,
and you can just,
because they're holding you, right?
Yeah. Like, you can, you might have lived this experience, but I can imagine the drop in morale of, you know, especially in a war zone of, you know, you're in a Jeep or a plane or you're heading into some kind of dangerous area and everybody's scared. Everybody knows that this could be their last moments. Everybody's aware of the danger, but then one person starts screaming how scared they are and starts, you know, like it has a panic attack and it's like, brings the confidence of everybody else down, right? Having one weak link.
Yeah.
And obviously that's a, you know, high level example of what a weak link can do, but even in any area of life, right, that you can have a strong team, but you're only as strong as your weakest member.
Exactly.
Right. And you certainly do not want to be the weakest member. And even using the example of sitting in the rain, and, you know, everybody knows this sucks. Everybody knows we're wet. Everybody knows we'd rather be at home watching football. But Are you going to be the one to complain about it? Right. Like, are you going to be the one, man, this sucks. Like, yeah, great. Okay. We already know that. Shut up. It's not going to help anything. Deal with the problem and move on. Yeah. Those people just get tiring very easily. The ones that find a problem and then complain about it. So that's a great lesson, that especially coming from war. Let's share number five and then we'll close off.
So number five, this is a tough one. Cause like, there's so many things you can learn from it, but I think what really got me was probably just listening to your superiors too, and being humble about what they show you. Like, these guys, when you're, and everyone who listens to this and been in the war, they understand, like, listening to your leadership, not necessarily like top, I'm talking like your squad leader or your team leader or your platoon sergeant, sometimes your lieutenant, depending on how gung-ho they are. But being able to listen to them and take what they want, because nobody wants to go to war as a leader and watch their guys die, right? That's like the worst thing I think people can go through. And like, I think understanding that too in a whole, as a whole, is like, what would happen if I died? And how would my team leader or my platoon sergeant or my squad leader think, and how would they feel? And I know with our situation, we lost about 14 guys when we were overseas, and nobody died. Thank God for that. But a lot of people lost. You know, we had a squad leader, two squad leaders, get medevaced out of the country. One lost his leg with an IED. Another one, which that story is wild. Another one who tripped a landmine, like not a landmine, a tripwire IED, which was like unheard of. And he took an IED to the face, and then the other two were there, you know, and we missed team leaders. We had a couple team leaders get blown up as well. We had, yeah, it was mainly IEDs, in our platoon where people, got injured the most, and being there and listening to them and help and just being a sponge, suck up all the information. You know, there's something that I really learned when I came back and I watched this TV show called Band of Brothers, and I'm sure a lot of people have probably seen it. And the guys that go into the Normandy, the ones who survived, they get back, they could get put back into the rear, and then you get an influx of new guys. And it's like the new guys coming in, they look kind of scared, but the top is like, you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
You know what I mean? And being that new guy, just suck up the information from the people who actually know it. And I think that's really, really important, because someone with my personality was like, I got this, I can do this, I don't need to listen to anybody else. But I think the reason why I'm still alive today is because of the training and the camaraderie and the love and the hope that my brothers gave me. I can do a little shout out for him. I one of my best squad leaders I've ever had, his name was Christopher Jensen. To this day, he's a hero of mine. I got another squad leader after he left. His name was Michael Dowd. Very, very great guy. Very harsh, but he meant it in the best way. And those two guys, I saved my life. You know, they what they showed me and how you know, hard they were with me, they saved my life. And there's so many other brothers from the platoon that were there to my left and my right throughout everything. And I have a very they're the reasons why I'm still here today. I have a very enormous amount of respect for every one of those brothers who made it through. And, you know, I pray for them all the time now that they're doing good and that they're trying to live their best life. Right. Mm-hmm. So
number five would be learn all you can and don't think you know everything.
Exactly. Exactly. Be humble. Be humble. Be open. And listen especially to people because, yeah. Yeah. Because those guys care. Those guys care.
Awesome. Yep. Well, thanks for sharing those with us, Jeremy. Not many people. I don't know what percentage of the population, but I'd imagine it's very, very small. The amount of people that were ever in military experience and the amount of people that were actually in combat is even smaller. Yeah, so yeah. To share those lessons, that very few people get to experience those life and death situations. And so thanks for sharing those with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. So hope you enjoyed this episode of Taming Tribulation, and we'll catch you next time.